From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We continue with Rochester and Western New York's favorite books of 2018, one of our favorite annual traditions to get ready to close the year here on Connections. In both of these hours, I've been joined by our producer, Megan Mack, the producer of Connections. We've heard a lot from folks in our community already. We've got a lot more to do here, don't we?
That's true. Get ready. Get your lists out so you can take some notes. We are continuing our conversations, and let's get started.
We begin hour two with a conversation with one of the most interesting people in Rochester. We're lucky to have him. Mark Brummett is a professor of Hebrew Bible interpretation at the Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. You may know him from some of his stage work. You might have recently seen him in the Rocky Horror Picture Show at Blackfriars. And Mark is, well, where are you from originally?
I grew up about 20 miles east of London, so kind of Cockney overspill.
London? I thought it was New Zealand.
No.
Okay. Cockney overspill.
Yes.
Tell me for 30 seconds about accents. Can you do different British accents?
Not very well. I'm not very good at accents. My mother was Northern. I can do her accent. And in my natural habitat, I sound something like Adele. In fact... A person of note who went to the same high school as me is Russell Brand.
Oh.
But his accent is not like any accent.
Yeah, you have this really distinguished, you know, sort of beautifully rounded. How did this happen?
I went to a drama school in central London, and I had to spend every morning having to do star jumps and ha ha ha's for a master's program. So I think, and my mother was a bit of a hyacinth bouquet type. So whatever accent she used at home, the moment we went out the front door, she had another one adopted, and we had to adopt the same refined posture.
Very nice. Well, we're supposed to be talking books here, and
yes.
the assignment for you was quite a challenge, you said. In fact, when you walked in the door for this interview, you handed me a book that we're not going to talk much about, but I do want to ask you, you almost chose a book by Lucinda Hawksley called Bitten by Witch Fever. The subject of which is something that I could not possibly have dreamed up in thousands of guesses.
Wallpaper, the use of arsenic in wallpaper, and the use of arsenic and wallpaper in poisoning. Apparently it was a 19th century thing. And so this book, not only is it beautiful, because
it is beautiful.
Page by page, yeah. There are examples of the wallpaper that used arsenic in its color stabilization, but in between these beautiful pages, there are stories of killings.
And it's just as good as you hoped.
Oh, it was a page-turner.
It really is a beautiful book. It's really nicely put together. It's called Bitten by Witch Fever, but we're going to set that aside because you finally, in the middle of the night, you were seized with this revelation that the book must be...
Frankenstein.
You're teaching it.
Yes, I've been teaching it this semester on a class on creation stories and the Bible. So we began with a Mesopotamian myth called the Enuma Elish, and we went to Gilgamesh and the Baal cycle from Syria and Genesis 1 to 11, the beginnings of the Jewish and Christian Bible, were the backbone of the class. But then we went on to Milton's Paradise Lost and Frankenstein.
Do many of your students come into this kind of a unit thinking, oh, I know the story of Frankenstein, but really what they know is sort of the stripped down Hollywooded version of Frankenstein?
Yes, and I also get a kind of, well, why would you teach that? And the reason is that it's a much more interesting, and it's not a long book, but a much more interesting book than you would imagine if you've only known some of the more contemporary and, well, 20th century receptions of it. And because the book is throughout in dialogue with Milton's Paradise Lost and the Bible, therefore. So it is a sophisticated read, let's say.
And we're on 200 years, yeah?
Yeah, 200 years this year. So it's its birthday, the monster's birthday. Yay!
when you sit back down with it yourself, can you do that as someone just to read for pleasure, or is it mostly academic for you?
No, I tend to read it for pleasure. When I'm reading it, I get engrossed in it, but then I don't find it unpleasurable to have academic responses.
It's interesting because I just sort of juxtaposed this idea that it must be either academic or pleasurable, which is really insulting to you and your students, sadly. My condolences to them.
I'm not ashamed to make them read things which they're not going to enjoy, but I hope that they would enjoy this, and I hoped that they would get something more from it than just a shock and horror style story, and they did.
Yeah, so in our last moments here with Frankenstein, your students' reviews of this, what are some of the notable comments you heard from them?
That it was much more a page-turner than anticipated, that it was much more engaged in the themes of our class than they'd ever known, that it's a much richer piece of writing. It's really written with the central theme of what is it like if you're abandoned by your creator? The creature's complaint throughout the novel is, I didn't ask to be made, and you have deserted me. And it's written by Mary Shelley at the beginning of the 19th century at a time when the authority of Christianity or traditional modes of Christianity are being challenged by the rise of the sciences. And we have the emerging religious sensibility we now call deism, which was the idea that, yes, God created the universe, but then wandered off and let it run on its own laws. So she's really expressing some of the contemporary debates by writing this novel, and they're debates which still have currency, therefore.
Yeah, and so let me conclude by asking you, you know, so often when we go back through outstanding pieces of literature, we, at least in my experience remembering as a student, we look for parallels, we look for meaning. And I sort of was always sitting in class wondering, did the author really intend this? Do we know how much Shelley really was trying to make these points?
Oh, very much. I mean, she was brought up in a world where these were the dinner table discussions. Mm-hmm. Her father and her mother, but her mother died when Mary Shelley was born, but her father had really fostered this kind of debate around the home and very much made sure that Mary Shelley was properly educated. And when I say properly educated, not just in tatting and painting. And on the opening page of her novel, she has a quote from Milton's Paradise Lost. Did I request thee, maker, from my day, from my clay, to mold me? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? So she puts in the mouth of the creature the question that Adam poses to God when he leaves the Garden of Eden.
200 years after Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, Mark Brummett chooses it for Rochester and Western New York's Standout Books in 2018. And I'm a little offended. This is our first time in the studio together. So will you come back in 2019?
Certainly I will, if Mark, you invite me.
You're invited. You are officially invited. That's
not
Mark
to
Brummett.
Talk about soccer.
It's called football. Sorry to correct you.
It is called football, and I was using the local term out of...
Don't be such a Philistine. Thank you, Mark.
It is Rochester's Favorite Books 2018. Our next guest is Penny Sterling, a local storyteller and frequent Connections guest. Welcome back.
Thank you for asking me. Hi.
Hi. And I just want to let our listeners know that you are dressed for the occasion. You yes. look fabulous. I love it.
Yes, I am. And I just recently got a dog, and so I've also brought some dog hair with me. I didn't recognize until we got into this light. Yeah.
That is a great skirt. We were making some jokes earlier about be here at noon on the dot, and you've come dressed in dots. So
yeah,
it's,
polka dots are my thing.
It's perfect.
I like houndstooth as well, and hounds. I got the hounds and the polka dots here, but not the tooth.
So, Penny, I gather that you're an avid reader.
Yes.
Based on the tweets that I see, what I read on social media. Was it difficult for you to choose one book to talk about?
Actually, I thought it would be, but then it turned out that I only read from beginning to end one book this year. I'm in the process of reading like six or seven different books, and I realized that I hadn't actually finished any of them except for one.
And which one is that?
That was a book by Neil Gaiman. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a fantastic author, and that way, in both meanings of the word, he writes about fantasy, and he's just an incredible author. And it's one of his lesser known books called Anansi Boys. Which, if you know who Neil Gaiman is, you probably know him from Sandman, which was his seminal comic books of like 20 years ago. And then he also wrote this amazing book called American Gods, which is now being made into a miniseries. And American Gods kind of like takes the Voltaire quote, if there was no God, mankind would have to invent them, and actually turned it around and said every time that we believe in a God, that God becomes real. And once, you know, once we stop believing in them, the gods are just like wandering around America looking for work. And it was a very interesting story, and it's about all these belief and the nature of America and all these things. And it's huge and sprawling and emotionally draining. And then after that, he wrote another book, taking one of the smaller gods from that book, Anansi, the spider, and did a little yarn about him. And not really about him, but about his children. He had two children, Fat Charlie, who was kind of the schlub, and then Fat Charlie's almost twin brother that he forgot he had, named Spider. And it's actually a story about storytelling, because Anansi is the god of tricks, but he's also the god of stories. He weaves stories like he weaves a web, and it's all about stories and the power of stories. And I think it's the reason, looking back, this was not why I read this, and this is not why I finished it, I don't think, except maybe subconsciously. I'm writing stories now, and I'm at a kind of like a crossroads in my life as to what I'm going to be doing and what I have been done. And like, I'm realizing that the job that I had, which was, I was separated from not voluntarily, my position was eliminated, and I've been underemployed, and I've been looking for work and not getting it, and I'm realizing I don't really want to do that anymore. I want to tell stories. I want to help people tell stories. And this book is a book about doing that and about believing in yourself and recognizing the power of the word. And so I think that's why it really resonated with me.
As a storyteller yourself, what do you look for in other people's stories? What draws you to particular stories?
Oh, so a lot of things. A hook off the top is always really good. A well-turned phrase, playfulness with the language, lightness, even in the dark times, of phrasing and pacing, and those are the main things I look for. And it's amazing how many incredibly good storytellers there are out there in so many different places, and how many people that you think might be good storytellers that really aren't.
Are you usually drawn to fantasy, to science fiction? You're a big Neil Gaiman fan, but is that your genre if you were to choose one?
It has always been that way. I don't know if it is still. I've realized that a lot of what I was reading have been biographies, and I was reading Carol Burnett's biography. Two of my, I guess, influences, biggest influences growing up were Carol Burnett from The Carol Burnett Show and John Cleese from Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I've been reading So Anyway, which is John Cleese's biography, and Amongst Such Good Company, which was Carol Burnett's. Which is just, I was hoping it would be about, you know, the story and the creative process, but it's really just a bunch of anecdotes about the people that were on the show, which was a fun and light read, but it was not as interesting as I was hoping it would be. And John's goes very deep, and it is a lot of introspection, and it's a lot of real hard soul work on his part to put this thing out. So. They were not what I was expecting, which I think is maybe why I didn't finish reading them yet, but I'm still going through them. But yeah, science fiction and fantasy have always been very, very important to me.
You've broken our rule and talked about more than one book.
I'm so sorry.
You're a rebel. I'm just kidding.
I will sit in the box and feel shame.
But repeat that Neil Gaiman book title for us again in case our listeners want to try to catch it in the new year.
It's Anansi Boys, A-N-A-N-S-I, Boys.
Perfect. Penny Sterling, thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me be here.
It's Rochester and Western New York's Favorite Books 2018, and our next guest is a local attorney and the immediate past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, Sarir Fazli. Welcome back to the program. Always nice to see you.
Thank you for having me back.
I was talking to Sarir before the program began, and we're going to give him a pass. He chose two books, but they're related, so we're going to allow it. So you get the pass here, Sarir. What did you choose?
Well, I chose these two, both by Michael Lewis. One is The Big Short, and the other is Liar's Poker. Both were written about a very scary time in the markets here and, of course, internationally. As one thing happens, everything happens. And they're both incredible reads on how the market mass and madness, if unhindered, really, the psychology of it just makes it run away. And God forbid anybody who wants to talk some sense about it is basically silenced.
Yeah, well, here we are recording this interview at a time where just in recent days, the market has seen some of the biggest drops in several years. It took all of, I think, 4 days on Wall Street to wipe out all of the market gains in 2018. And now, at least at the recording of this interview, though who knows tomorrow and the next day, the market negative for the year. And those swingy times are nervous times for everyone. So even though Liar's Poker goes back almost a generation now, Big Short several years, does it feel fresh?
Well, it's the ironic thing, if you can say, is that back then the fundamentals didn't seem to exist, yet we had a runaway market, housing, and our financial markets. And today, all we hear about is increasing revenues for business, near full employment. It's tough for people to find a job. Unemployment is an all-time low, yet there is havoc all of a sudden in the markets. And 2018 has been, you know, it's been a baseless rise if we look at it, not understanding why the market went up so much and now has gone down so much. And we hear only good things coming out of the employment in the business sectors.
And the administration for a while anyway. So this is what Michael Lewis does, though. I read his stuff and I get, I feel like I learn a lot about what's actually happening and I get a little scared because even when things seem good, he's very good at uncovering some of the shaky ground on which our economy has been built at times.
I think some of the things that he writes about are not just the bets, for want of a better word, that get made on what the market may or may not do and how these other securities are all packaged together and, you know, they take the meat that nobody wants and they make hot dogs out of it and they put them in a bright package and say, oh, look at how fantastic this is. But then how they then market those things that were average to below average separately, but all of a sudden they've become this great security that people started buying up and really not just taking pieces of it, but buying big, big chunks of it. Similarly, you know, with the housing market, what happened to it when they talk about it is how the interest rates would go down. People kept borrowing more, refinancing, then they started to go up again. And ultimately, there was no more refinancing that could be done. And that's when everything hit the fan.
Well, Michael Lewis is one of my favorite writers. He wrote a piece a generation ago, a long form article called J School Confidential that kind of uncovered what he saw as the problems of journalism school. He's got a great eye for telling stories. So before we wrap the interview, I'll just ask you, you know, these are subjects that can seem really dense or esoteric, especially if you don't have a degree in finance. And yet, do you find that he's able to sort of turn it into a thriller in some ways?
He really does, because I think he takes the time to explain his terms. He breaks it down. He gives some good examples. And I got to tell you, after you read the book, especially if you watch the movies, they're even better in breaking it down and showing you how things get done. But it's the bet, it's the side bet, it's the bet on who's going to win the initial bet. All of the things that are happening in these books, they're relatively easy to understand if you take the time to sit down and focus on it. And then the book, it just reads itself. It really is. It's an amazing, they're both amazing page turners.
I'm glad you grabbed onto this because it is still so relevant. Michael Lewis himself said in a recent interview, he wishes Liar's Poker and Big Short were outdated, were you know, sort of irrelevant relics. But unfortunately, a lot of the underlying problems are still there. So it's good for us to understand that. Sarir Fazli with The Big Short and Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis. Happy New Year. Let's talk in 2019.
I will look forward to it. Thank you for having me again.
Our next guest is Chris Fanning, the Director of Communications at Writers and Books, also the Associate Producer of the Rochester Fringe Festival. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks for having me back.
So you work at Writers and Books. You are surrounded by books every day of your life. How did you choose just one to talk about?
Well, this one, the book that I picked, it had a real impact on me when I got it. I got it last year for Christmas and read it in the new year. And has surprisingly been very topical this year. So it was really a no-brainer for me when you asked me to pick one.
And what is the book?
The book is Boy Erased by Garrett Conley, which is a memoir about his life growing up in Arkansas as a gay man, being outed kind of against his will, and being sent to conversion therapy. So a heavy memoir.
Was it difficult for you to, I don't know if you were reading that for pleasure, I assume you were.
Mm-hmm.
Is it tough to sit down and read something that is that heavy and that dark and that difficult to grasp? You know, when you want to sit down and just escape, how do you manage that?
Right. Well, the book appealed to me because as a gay man, I was interested in reading, you know, LGBTQ literature. The cover is beautiful. That's actually what grabbed my eye first before I even knew anything about the book. You know, reading for pleasure, I think pleasure is kind of misleading because that's not always, you're not reading for a good time, you're reading for an experience. And this book takes place in the 90s. I mean, the author is only 5 or 6 years older than me. So someone who had a very opposite experience as a gay man in upstate New York reading about this experience, it was exposing for me.
When you consider all of the national conversations that we're having right now about conversion therapy, about LGBTQ rights, do you think these personal experiences are getting in the hands or the ears of the right people?
I hope so. I think, you know, especially in the past couple of years, we're being kind of more awake to these things that have been happening for years and this book in particular got great reviews, so much so that it's been made into a movie. The Little is still screening it. If you're listening to this, go see Boy Erased at The Little. So that also, you know, that helps lend a hand in getting the word out and educating people, especially the cast. It's Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman and Lucas Hutches, I think is his name. So, you know, a star-studded cast also helps bring in people who may not necessarily have gone to see this movie had it been like an indie underground film.
I ask that question because we talk a lot about the power of personal stories on the show. So when we talk about subjects that can easily lend themselves to discussing them in terms of numbers or statistics, we always try to bring in a first-person perspective.
Sure.
So when you sit down with a book like that, or if you hear from someone who has experienced something like that and you can come to relate to them on a human level, it changes the course of conversation. And for you, sitting down and reading about that and then drawing in your own experiences or non-experiences,
right. Mm-hmm.
does it change the way that you look at anything?
I remember after reading it, just closing that last page and kind of doing some reflection on it and how lucky I've been with my friends and especially my family who have never, you know, treated me differently when I came out to them. And reading the story about, you know, the difficulties of somebody, you know, I was that age when I came out. I never, you know, conversion therapy wasn't even a concept to me. And to read this perspective and, you know, it was like putting on his shoes for me. And I've lent this book out to many other people, not necessarily in the gay community, and they also get something out of it as well. So it's not just for one demographic to read.
Is there anyone that you lent it to that maybe had a different view of compared to you prior to reading the book and then their opinion changed?
You know, not that I know of, and I've been very vocal about it for the past year on social media.
Yeah.
And actually, the author came to U of R this past spring, and I got to meet him and talk to him, and we talked books and about writers and books, and it was great. And that was, you know, he just gave us facts, and everyone there, I think, walked away with something. But I haven't experienced anything of somebody being like, thank you for opening my eyes. If you're out there, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, let us know. Email us, connections at WXXI.org. Yeah. Chris Fanning, thank you so much.
Oh, Megan, thanks for having me, and happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays.
Our next guest, as we discuss Rochester and Western New York's favorite books 2018, is Megan DeChanteauvieux, who is the president and CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center. We always appreciate the conversation. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Well, what did you choose for the standout read of the year? What's the name of the book? What's the author?
Well, the book is called Let the Great World Spin. The author is Colin McCann. It's actually a book from 2009, so I'm a little bit late, but I've read it many times over the years, and it continues to be my favorite.
Okay. And why is this one what stands out to you most here?
I appreciate language, and it is beautifully written. So even reading the first couple of pages, the prologue, I have to stop and put the book down and take a breath. It's incredible to see how the author puts the story together and how they phrase the... Each sentence is just, it's like poetry. It's absolutely beautiful. And the stories that are told through this book are so moving and compelling, and the author demonstrates such empathy for every character. It's the kind of story that pulls together multiple different lives and intersects them in ways that really restore your faith in humanity and show the complexities of everyone's life and our intentions moving through it.
It's fiction, right?
It is fiction. It's based on, there was a true story of in August of 1974, there was a man who stretched a tightrope, a cable, across the Twin Towers, and he walked across, a tightrope walker. And so that actually happened. And then the story, the fiction piece of it, is the author coming up with all of the people who were on the ground or somehow watching this unfold and watching this man cross this tightrope across the towers, and then how their lives were impacted by that moment, and a bit of the precariousness of life in general. So taking that analogy of the tightrope walker and putting it into each of these stories. There's one in particular that really speaks to me about the author's empathy and the way that we view the world. There is a story of a grandmother who was kind of peripheral to the events. She is a heroin addict, and she is a prostitute, and she sold her daughter into prostitution, and she has these grandbabies, and she's in jail. And you have so much empathy for this character as you're reading about her, and you just love her and want her to succeed and want the best for her. And for all of those judgments that we place on people, this author sort of flips that around and makes you see the humanity in all of us.
Mm. The book is Let the Great World Spin by Colm McCann. Colm, C-O-L-U-M. Colm McCann. Megan DeChanteauvieux, President and CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center. Thanks for sharing the book with us.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Happy New Year. We'll talk to you again in 2019.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Kyle Semmel. He's a local writer and the former director of Writers and Books, and he has read so many books. I'm so excited to hear what he chose for Rochester's favorite books of 2018. Welcome, Kyle.
Welcome. Thank you.
So you have a book in front of you. Before we talk about that book specifically, I was mentioning before we sat down that I don't have a lot of opportunities to read outside of show material, which, you know, we get a lot of great books for the show. But I'd like to expand my horizons a little bit. You said you could relate.
Yes. When I got the invitation for this show, and I started thinking about all the books I'd read this year, and one book stood out, and I realized why it stood out to me. The book that stood out is Rian Amilcar Scott's Insurrections. It's a collection of stories that was published late 2017, I believe, from the University of Kentucky Press. What stood out to me was the fact that I took a week off from work in March, and I went out to Canisius Lake, rented a cabin, and was just by myself, and I read three books that week. I wrote, and I just took some time to do something that was not work-related, and that gave me a little bit of peace of mind. But I found the time to actually read these books. George Saunders' Civil War Land and Bad Klein was one, and Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time was the other. That was an audiobook. That was what I would read as I went to bed. But it was a really wonderful experience, and it just helped me to kind of ground myself back to the thing that I really love to do, and that is reading. And you had mentioned earlier that, you know, getting back to reading outside of the show and stuff. And it's one thing that, you know, so many people, we work so many hours, long hours, and we have to make ends meet. We have to do this, that, and the other thing. And reading is always, it seems, pushed to the side. It's easier to watch a television program than to actually read a book. It's more passive that way. Reading does require a little more effort, and in particular fiction, which is why, of course, I chose a collection of short stories. It's of all the types of books that one can read, stories tend to be you either really, really love them and read them all the time, or you're kind of lukewarm to them, it seems. At least in my experience, people are somewhat lukewarm or they love them to death. And I really enjoyed this collection. It is a debut collection, and he won a number of prizes for the book, including the 2017 Penn America Robert Bingham Prize for debut fiction. It is set in a fictional town of Cross River, Maryland, which is kind of like a Yaknapatawpha type of scenario, primarily black characters, with a lot of living in America type of themes for black men and women. The story that I reread this morning in order to kind of prepare for it was, or is called 202 Checkmates. And essentially it is a coming of age story about a little girl, an 11-year-old girl who plays chess with her dad. And through the experience of losing 202 times to her dad, she becomes a better chess player. But like all good stories, there's much more going on behind it. And it's about a girl who's becoming, you know, entering puberty, seeing the relationship between her mother and father in a different way, and, of course, learning some of the economic hardships that the family is going through, things that slowly begin to dawn on her and we as readers are seeing. And it's a rich story in that way, and it's touching, too, in the end, when we as readers get a glimpse of the father as somebody who's out of a job, who loves his daughter, loves the game of chess, and is teaching her something of value that she begins to understand and accept. And then at the end, she knows that she can beat him, but doesn't. And I think it's a very moving story. So
you mentioned there are collections where you read every story and you love every story, and then there are those where you're sort of turned off. I've had that experience. I've loved everything I've read in George Saunders' collections, Mary Gateskill. So you've loved everything you've read in this particular book?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because the answer is no. There are a few collections that I could say 100% I love every single story in that. I go back to Joyce Carol Oates' collection Heat from 1991. That's a wonderful collection of stories. I just read Ben Fountain's, I forget the name of the book, actually. It's about, it has Che Guevara in the title, but it's a collection of stories. He's a terrific writer. And even there were a couple stories that didn't have the same level as some of the other stories. So I think with stories, and that may be one of the parts that people don't like about stories, is that you don't always get to dive deep into this the character's stories. And because of that, you kind of feel like when you're at the end of the story, what have you read? Have you been, changed in any way, if that's what you're looking for in fiction? And it just, the package is just too small for some people, which is not to say that it's not a good package. It's just that some people do struggle with that, which is unfortunate, because when you put them together in a collection, like a good album, Blood on the Tracks, my favorite album, put that together as a package like that, and you see it as a whole, and it's an amazing experience, even if some of the individual pieces aren't quite what another piece is. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. It does. Repeat the title and author for us again.
So the book is called Insurrections. It's a collection of stories by Rian Amakar Scott.
Thank you. Kyle Semmel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there are more books coming your way here on Connections as we continue our annual tradition of talking about Rochester and Western New York's favorite books. So grab a pen and a paper. We'll have more for you to add to your reading list. That's next on Connections.
It's Rochester and Western New York's Favorite Books 2018, one of our favorite annual traditions, where we take a sampling of what the community has been reading this year and what they would recommend for us to check out as we head into 2019. Our next guest is Barry Strauber, who's a professor of advertising in the School of Communication at RIT. Was very excited to come in and share a book with us. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Evan?
Very good. So the book you chose is what?
I chose the autobiography of Bruce Springsteen called Born to Run, and he wrote this a couple of years ago. It came out in 2016. So unusual. It's in his voice of his life and what he's done and the accomplishments he's made, and pretty amazing book.
Yeah. In the email that we were exchanging before this program, there were some specific things that stood out to you about why this how his voice really came through. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, the honesty of his voice, some parts of the book he talks about experiencing depression and going through some physical and emotional problems. This usually is not in a rock star's biography. So this was meant to be sort of a in the truest sense, a tell-all. And for all his fans, I mean, I've seen him, I'm sure there are other fans out there. I've seen him 49 times.
49.
Yes. First time I saw him was in 1975, so that gets easier to figure out how old I am. But because of his fans and because of his connection to them, this sort of maniacal sort of attention to his fans and how they are, this book became, the only way he could do it, which is, in his own voice, which is really a great way to set your biography in stone so people know what it is.
Just last month, he did an interview where he was asked how involved in the political and electoral process he wants to be heading into 2020. And his earnest answer was he didn't know, that he had some moments where he felt very proud. He worked very hard on the Obama campaigns. He campaigned for Hillary Clinton. Obviously, that election did not go the way that Bruce Springsteen wanted. Mm-hmm. But he also said that he thinks sometimes the weight of a voice gets diluted by overexposure, so maybe he should pull back a little. How much does he weigh into politics in the
book? Oh, I mean, the funny thing is it's unlikely of a young man from, Asbury Park, New Jersey, who has no, history of, when he was a kid, of having anything connected to politics or anything like that. But I think if you look at his songs early on, he was talking about, the song he does called My Hometown, really early song, talking about what goes on in the politics of cities and how they can degrade. And so he was always interested in that. And I think now what he's done is he's making it part of his sort of contribution as an older rock star to be able to really make an effect on people with his fame and do something, maybe that'll be connected to politics. A lot of his fans always wanted him to run for something, but I think he probably doesn't want to do that exactly. He has this other job that he likes to do. But I think he's got great, great commitments to wanting to make the world a better place. That's always been his agenda, even as a rock star and certainly as a citizen. He wants to do everything to make the world a better place. And if his fame allows him to have a connection and an impression on people, that's great. That's really great.
My favorite modern Bruce song is We Take Care of Our Own, because to me, that's still a great rock anthem. This is a band that is still cranking out great rock anthems centered on values and that you cannot question that come through right through the music. What's the best Bruce song?
Best Bruce song for me? That's a good question because I love them all so much. I like the album Rising. So I like that song Rising because it was immediately right after 9/11. Yep. The story was that somebody in New Jersey passed him in a car, closed the window down right after 9/11 it happened and said, "We need you now." And he went out and did that album. And so Rising is always going to be a special place. But, I'm also for the all-out sort of rock songs that he has on there as well.
Well, the book is Born to Run, Bruce Springsteen's autobiography. Barry, Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in and sharing with us.
You too. Thank you, Evan.
Our next guest is Reverend Judy Davis. She's the commissioner-elect for the Rochester City School Board. Welcome to you, Judy.
Oh, thank you.
It's nice to see
you.
Thank you, mate. Was it difficult for you to choose a book?
It was at first. I actually had another book in mind, but I chose this one because I wanted to be able to share passion that I have in addressing institutional racism and how it's different from individual, because I think that's kind of confusing in society. So I thought Tim Weiss's book, Speaking Treason Fluently, would be the book to talk about today. And Tim Weiss is uplifting that when persons of color, when African Americans dare to critique America, instead of understanding this is a critique so that we can be better as a whole, it's really felt and experienced by some white persons as treason, as not showing allegiance or being patriotic to the United States. And so that's why I chose this book, because we have to understand that giving a critique of the United States and the way that inequitable outcomes are happening does not mean that person doesn't have allegiance to the United States.
I think this relates to a conversation we had on the talk show a few times about, is America great? Governor Cuomo made those comments over the summer during a press conference, in which I think he was discussing gender disparities. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you know, America is not so great. And what you just said, can we critique and look forward without being considered not allegiant? Mm-hmm. So what does the book tackle in terms of that? I mean, how does it...
So first, Tim starts out to help us understand the difference between individual acts and collective acts, institutional, structural racism. So for some examples that Rochester probably might remember, an individual act might be like Imus. You remember Imus in the Morning called the female's nappy-headed hose. I think right here in Rochester, Jack Moore called the city cousins. And I've heard in the past that Bob Lonsberry, referring to former Mayor Johnson, would play monkey music or ape music or something like that. Those are individual acts. And as long as I say to myself in my home, well, I would never do that. So there's nothing wrong. America's great. There's nothing for me to do. So as long as we focus and think racism is all about these individual acts, we won't move or see that there is something that needs to be done. So Tim Weiss talks about, well, why doesn't the media cover collective institutional acts that are taking place? So some of the things that he uplifted is that there's widespread racism in healthcare. Remember, this is an older book, so I'm not saying that these are the current stats. But the American Journal of Public Health published an article that shared that nearly 900,000 blacks died between 1991 and 2000 who would not have died had they had access to health care that was equal to that received by the average white person. Another example that he gives is the widespread racism in housing, the gentrification that's taking place, and that 2 and 3 million cases of housing discrimination take place each year, and that there's a forced serial displacement of black and brown communities, even happening right here in Rochester. And that the last one that he does uplift is racism in criminal justice, in that 70% of all drug users, again, the stats at this time, are white, yet the war on drugs has led to the mass incarceration of blacks and Latinos. So how does that happen? So when people of color start do this truth-telling, and Tim Weiss starts this truth-telling, and we question the morality of every institution and its policies, practices, procedures, how, when they're implemented, they create these inequitable outcomes by race. For some reason, when African Americans or Latinos, when we point out, when we are the truth tellers, it's received by white America as treason, as not being allegiant to the United States. Dr. Robin DiAngelo uplifts that there's this good-bad binary that happens within white persons. That's who she works with. And the thought is, I'm a good person, and I have to retain the understanding that I'm a good person. So how can I be a good person, and yet I participate in systems and institutions that are generating these results in black and brown communities? How can I be a good person and realize that there's some benefits flowing to me by virtue of how laws, policies, and practices are put together? And how do I deal with, I'm a good person, but I'm silent about all of it? And so when these truth tellers, African Americans, come along and start telling the truth, it triggers cognitive dissonance. I have to find a way to still retain in my mind that I am a good person. So these things can't be. Racism at the institutional level, it can't exist. It can't be what you're saying. So I wanted to share the four ways in which whites deny the existence of institutional racism as shared by Tim Weiss, and the typical statements that might be made. One is to minimize and to say that people of color are not victims, that it doesn't exist. And so persons might say, it's not as bad as you're saying, it's not about race, or I'm tired of, you know, you people playing the race card. Persons might also rationalize, well, they'll uplift other reasons why things are happening. So what about Obama? What about Oprah? But in response to that, the existence of persistent racism doesn't mean that a few people can't rise. Another one is deflection, where the person will condemn white racism, but at the same time shift blame to the victim for racism. So the person might say, it's time for people of color to take responsibilities for their lives. They get pregnant and shoot each other. So uplifting things like that to, again, deflect from the reality of the examples that I shared before. And then last but not least is competing victimization, where whites will say, well, we're the victims, and that affirmative action is reverse discrimination, and that blacks are taking all the jobs. So those are the four areas that will be utilized by whites to deny the existence of institutional racism.
It sounds like this book is promoting the idea of it's okay to have conversations that are uncomfortable. It's okay to think about things that make you uncomfortable or question how you feel about them. You've done a lot of work on this subject, and I know that that defines a lot of your day, trying to have conversations about how to educate people. How does this book stand out in terms of that? I'm sure you've read so much. Why does this book stand out to you?
Because really this is, I think this book provides a skeleton, and then you can put in more deep stuff. This isn't even deep yet.
I will say Judy has, I think, 10 pages of notes that she came in to talk about for 5 minutes. So we'll have to do a whole separate hour. But
yeah.
Okay. So it provides a skeleton for people
to. It really does. It's a great skeleton to start. If we can come to the place where I'm not trying to tell you you're not a good person, we have to let go of this good, bad binary. It's not about that. It's about we want to make America a place where all persons can live and have opportunity and have access to the same kinds of lifestyles.
I'm sure we're going to be talking with you a lot more in the new year, Reverend Davis. So thank you for coming in. Repeat the title of the book again and the author.
The title is Speaking Treason Fluently.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thanks for New Year to you. Thank you so much.
Our next guest is from just down the hall. The music director and midday host at Classical 91.5, Julia Figueres, is with us. And really, you're part of the reason we're doing this, Jules. You love books. You're kind of the book fairy around this time of year because your friends and family, you're always thinking about great gifts for them and what they would love to read, what you've read this year. And interestingly, when I said, hey, can you choose a book from this year, you read a lot, but you knew immediately what you wanted to talk
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Hands down. I was talking to my stepmom on the phone just around a few weeks back. And she said, you know, this book came up in our book club. It's called Educated by Tara Westover. It's fabulous. You should read this. So for some reason, I actually immediately bought it and couldn't put it down ever, ever, ever. It was the most extraordinary thing I've read in a long time.
Educated is the name of the book.
Educated.
By Tara Westover. What's it about?
Well, it's about a woman. It's a memoir who grew up in a very breakaway, isolationist Mormon household in Idaho. And she never went to school. Never. I never went to school. She now has a PhD from Cambridge. And it's her journey in this world that is so unlike any world you or I have ever even seen, much less, you know, could really understand. And it's pretty horrific at times. The life that she had as a kid and even as a young adult was really awful, really awful. Such problems in her family, mental health issues with her father, with her brother, a lot of violence. And yet she rose above and got her degree. And none of it feels like one of those great rise above stories, but it's just so compelling because it's a world that you and I have never set foot in, and I'm not sure I would ever want to.
So I suspect you've read a considerable breadth of memoir, and there is kind of the genre of rising above, et cetera, that can become cliche. And that's not to say that these personal stories of triumph aren't valid and valuable and inspiring. It's just that there's a genre to it. It seems to me that you feel this one was somehow different or stands apart in that genre.
Well, it stands apart because her family was never with her. I mean, this whole idea of going to college, going to school at all, that was the devil's work. And it's interesting is to note that she and two of her brothers all have PhDs. So they really broke away from this family, but they didn't have support from each other. And it was a journey that she walked into. I mean, can you imagine walking into a university and not knowing what the Holocaust was? She,
wow,
this is true. And she went to Brigham Young not knowing anything. She had no idea of the outside world and no idea of history as it had happened to that point. And so it's not a rising above, but rather a discovery of the world around you and who you are, and in this case, who she is and where she fits in this world. So it's a very different kind of story.
That is amazing. I mean, as you know, with children, there are times where your children will come home at various ages and you'll say, where did you learn that? But they might learn it from friends or at school. Well, she, this woman in this case, was so sheltered and so kept in this tight bubble that there was no opportunity to absorb that kind of knowledge in any setting, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
And yet, as she got older, doesn't sound like she feared it, or it sounds like she wanted to discover the world that she didn't know.
And it all began with her brother, who wanted to discover this world, who knew that there was a world beyond, wow, that farm, beyond that house, and beyond that junkyard that they owned, and encouraged her. And he found classical music and would listen to it. And it was that music that helped broaden that world as well. And it was because they had this wonderful relationship that he encouraged her to do the same. She was the only girl. No, actually, she had sisters, but at that point, I think she was the baby. But he really said, no, you can do this. And she did. And it's amazing to see where she came from and where she has come and how humble she is through the whole process.
All right, the name of the book and the author?
Educated by Tara Westover.
Thank you for sharing with us, Jules, and we're going to hear you on 91.5 as always. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and you're welcome.
And that's another edition of Rochester and Western New York's Favorite Books, the 2018 edition. We want to thank you so much for joining us over the past 2 hours, listening to our community members talk about their favorite books. We'll have a list of all of those titles and authors on our website, so you can check them out there. Add to your reading list for 2019. On behalf of Evan Dawson and myself, thank you again for joining us. We'll talk to you next year.